Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everyone. Today's Friday. It's March 29th and 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. Just a wonderful day. Also, a great way to start off the weekend. And my name is Hezzy Eris, and our most esteemed guest is Dr. Richard Cerulli. He's a PhD, and he's going to delve into his growing body of work regarding societal evolution. And this particular day, we're going to speak to him about the Boomerang series. That's his everything falls under that heading. But we can talk to him about a Lebanese oud to a Fender loud. And it's all in memory of a guy by the name of Richard Anthony Mansour. And so let's find out. Oh, I see Richard's already on. Good morning, Richard. How are you?
Good morning, Hesse. How are we doing this morning?
Doing okay, and I'm feeling a lot better, just being able to talk to you. I was so overwhelmed by this particular article because I had no idea what you were talking about, but I had no idea how we had lost sight of this man by the name of Richard Anthony Mansour, and we had lost sight of his heritage. And it's so compelling how in one generation from leaving Lebanon and his family landing in Boston, and then eventually him going out to California, and he changed our whole entire American music scene. That is
exactly.
So compelling. It is mind-boggling.
Before we even
start to talk about him and his legacy, what is it about? Is it strictly an American thing, or is it an international thing where we seem to extract the heritage of our people and they go unknown? It's almost like they're walking around and we don't even know who they are.
Exactly. How I came about this was by accident, but it was very interesting. A coworker or a fellow profession who knows my background and plays and I write music comes up to me and says, "Rich,
right.
Did you hear this? Dick Dale passed away." And I said, "No, I haven't." And of course, I just read the obituary and my mind started drifting back to that period of time. And I said, I remember getting that first Beach Boys album, in hi-fi. And
yeah.
You saw these blonde, blue-eyed kids with the guys in the surfboard. And, this is the mid-60s. And this is what America was looking like. This is what marketers saw. This is what we were all about. And, let's go surfing, this whole bit, the Frankie Avalon things.
But they were all like you said, they were all blonde and blue-eyed and surfing on the West Coast. And, my God, your music was all that. And Annette Funicello and all those characters. Who would have thought any of them had any Middle Eastern quality or heritage?
Yeah.
And then renaming this guy, his name, renaming him with an American name, it like took the last vestige of his Middle Eastern background away.
Yeah, it's if we watch it, it's so interesting because the Beach Boys, like three of them, their name was Wilson, Jardine,
right.
Love, so they were your very typical all American names, but because you just imagine if on the cover of the Beach Boy album you had a picture of Richard Anthony Mansour,
right.
At surfing, it probably just, but looking at his history and the fact that, he comes from a Lebanese descent, he was taught to play the oud and he takes it and he gets a guitar and he realizes he's left-handed and he just gets a guitar and just turns it upside down. He doesn't even restring it. Starts playing these Middle Eastern scales, which are unknown to, of course, the American rock scene. And the next thing he's playing, and it grabs on. I mean, there's that first song of his, that Mr. Lou is, I believe it's a Lebanese folk song that was just, you know,
yeah,
a little bit
it
upbeat. So he takes this heritage of music and culture, comes to the United States, starts surfing, and he combines it, and America embraces it. You know, the West Coast,
right,
and the Beach Boys, obviously, and all of a sudden we have surf music. And he teams up with Leon Fender, you know, the inventor of the solid body guitar. And, you
right,
know, we just have this combination of music and culture culminating on the American shore. And, you know, people are watching these movies and saying, wow, look at this. This is the American way. And no one's saying, hey, it's really Lebanese.
Right. Which is so compelling.
Yeah,
and then you traced just the fact that we renamed him, you know, Richard Dale, or Dick Dale.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this is insanity. So why do we do that?
Yeah, you know, it's that's always a problem with. I'm sorry, any speaking, it just seems to aggravate my vocal cords. But Yeah, it was the only thing I thought was interesting is, you know, Annette Funicello was able to keep her last name in the whole thing, you know.
Right.
So, you know, but all in all, I mean, you know, speaking, you know, we both come from, immigrant, descent, and there was always that question of, you know, gelling in a sense that, you know, a lot of people changed their names, they dropped the vowels, and whatever, and they try to make it more American, and you know, and I'm kind of neutral on that. You know, I'm very proud of my heritage, as everyone should be proud of their heritage.
Right.
And you know, some of them just thought, you know, let's just make our names, you know, a little bit more easier. You know, as an Italian American, we had a lot of vowels in our names, and I remember when my grandparents came over, their original name was Salimbeni. And when they got to Ellis Island, they said, it's Salimbeni. And they said, we can't spell it. I said, let alone, we can't even pronounce it. So your name's Sabino.
Yeah.
And so, so it went from Salimbeni to Sabino, which was not even close, you know. And but I think that was just part of, you know, the, quote, the American experience. But, you know, going back to
that's what makes the American experience so unique, because they somehow American society just wants to change everything. So it becomes amorphous and to always define anybody by their name, because like you said, the vowels are dropped or this is added or you get a completely different name altogether. And I think the richness of who we are as a nation gets lost in the shuffle and the redo, you know. And you know, it also creates animosity later on in our lives when people say, well, oh, I didn't know he had that heritage or she had that heritage. And I hate those people, but you love them. You know, which is amazing. You know, we love their music, so how can we hate them individually? Or we like their painting or their writing. And so I wonder if this is a good dynamic for the American dream. I mean, the dream is evidently still working, but we have a lot of fissures in our society somehow.
Yeah, you know, and it was it's a good point, you know, because here these, you know, most people are listening to this guitarist who had made a great contribution to American music, and thinking like, you know, good old American boy, you know, good old American boy. But I wonder how many people said, wow, he's Lebanese. Yeah, I don't know if I like his music, you know. I'm just, hopefully that was never the case, but, you know, it would have been nice to retain that, but, you know, taking that music from the Middle East, especially today with tensions are so high in the Middle East, that can you imagine, you know, and to have that background to come in and be actually the basis of an all American sound, You know, it's a little ironic, you know, when probably when he was in his prime, when you probably mentioned, you know, Arabs or things like that, it had probably had such a negative connotation about it, or a very different perception. And, you know, basically, you know, foreigners, and not realizing that
this fellow
carved out the American sound.
Yeah, but you know what's so interesting is that there was a character who actually, I believe, actually lived in Yonkers. His name was Danny K. Danny Thomas. I'm sorry, Danny Thomas.
Yeah.
And he was a TV personality. He had that long nose. You know, he's a Jewish nose, Middle Eastern nose, whatever. But people loved him to death, and he was like. I don't know. He was just loved by everyone. And then he was very much magnanimous. A St. Jude's Hospital, that all came out of his effort. And
his daughter's
still carrying on. But
that's right.
We knew he was of Arab descent. And
that didn't turn
us off. So how did you even discover?
Yeah.
So it did come up years later. People didn't really know who he was originally in America.
Make room for daddy or make room for Danny or dad. Remember he had an uncle Tanous that would come over. And, Remember
we didn't
that?
Know who we didn't know who Uncle Tanous was or where he came from, did we?
Yeah, and so there was, you know, interesting time, you know, that you know, even growing up in the 50s, you know, or in grade school in the 50s, you know, you would, I don't want to date myself, you'd have these textbooks, you know, and they always refer to America as the melting pot, you know, and, you know, it was, and, you know, it's odd, like, there, and I grew up. We grew on a street that was, you know, they had the term diversity back then, but it was interesting how people could live together oblivious to the fact that there's people that want to create social tensions. It was a mixed, I would say, blue collar, white collar neighborhood. There were doctors who had their offices on tree lined street. You had police officers. You had teachers, and you had a couple of construction workers, and you had every mix of person on that street. And no one ever would think, like, you know, well, you know, they're Irish, they're Polish, they're Italian, they're Jewish. It was, you know, we just got out, we talked, and, you know, we're pretty much oblivious to it. So growing up in that part, but of course the 60s, you know, we began to see, you know, prejudice, racism, and things like that. So, but it kind of came, you know, full circle, you know, because
but isn't it interesting, though, that when people came in the 50s or maybe earlier to the United States, there was almost maybe not a welcome wagon for anybody, but certainly animosity or a bigotry. Yeah, but there was no real bigotry. And everybody settled in, and the communities were all basically in the same socioeconomic plane, it seemed.
Yep.
When did we become so much more bigoted? What's interesting, though, is that the black community never quite made it as quickly as these new immigrants, wherever they came from, whether they came from Europe or whether they came from Africa or the Middle East or South America.
Yeah.
They didn't have an easy time of it. What changed in America, do you know, that caused the bias to come out? It must have been always there. There is no such thing as covering up bias. If you're biased, you're biased. There's a bigotry there, then you have it. You know, they even talk about now anti-Semitism on the rise. No, it's not. It's the same thing that's always been. It's not going away. So what caused our American society to be that way? Because now I'm starting to see the same sort of thing being replicated in Europe.
Yeah.
You know, anti-immigrant.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those studies which I don't think the academic community has really, or what I've seen, I can't make a broad brush statement, but, you know, a lot of times the academic community is driven by, you know, what's politically correct or what's the topic du jour. And they sometimes, I have to be honest, they miss it by a long shot. And if you, you know, you look at just what happens, we all know that when I try to use like a term about racism, bigotry, you know, I always like to use the example like back in the 50s or early 60s, you had those TV Westerns that were, you know, always high rated. There's probably tons of them. And and a good part of them always started, or certainly, you know, even the movies, is everybody sitting around in the bar or the saloon having a grand old time drinking, and a stranger walks in. And of course, you know, they, you know, and it goes quiet, and, you know, and everybody's looking at this person, and, you know, he dresses a little different, and, you know, and all of a sudden, Predator just comes out. Hey, there's something different in our environment. Attack. Yeah. It's not us. And that's like, I think, an inherent frailty in our human anthropology. And I don't think we've grown out of that. I mean, we've gotten better. But I don't, you know, I think to a degree it is inbred, because it just gets, you know, we just transform, you know, our bias and from one to another. You know, then we finally gain the acceptance. We say, let's move on to something else. You know, let's find something else that we do. It's like a cancer. You know, it's like you get rid of one tumor and it just pops up someplace else, you know. And, and people just don't really want to address it. And, you know, it's so odd when you look at, not odd, it's pretty pathetic when you look at the African-American experience. I mean, first of all, they were brought here as slaves. Their families were taken apart. And, you know, could you imagine, you know, somebody going to a family and say, I'm selling you here, and you're, and they have to break up families with no recourse. And they're like, wow, what would happen if that happened to me? And they did this, and you enslave people, and then, and you can't understand why they want to be free. Like,
it's so interesting is that dynamic you just showed, you know, with how the African Americans that came over here as slaves, their family was split, and that same sensibility of history, and that's maybe because we don't know it. When people were crossing over the border into the United States, looking for asylum, and their children were separated from the parents, and we lost track of where these kids were or who they're connected to. And the outrage was not as much as one would think. Because and even more so from the African American community, they were quiet.
Yeah,
so this really brings up unbelievable tensions and, you know, difficulties to fathom, and even to contemplate why we're allowing this to repeat itself, which is interesting.
Yeah, and that's what even makes it even more sad, in the sense that it repeats itself. There's never a lesson learned. No. And it gets progressively worse. And then just think of how pathetic it becomes. So when Lincoln says free the slaves, okay, they got freedom, okay. And then all of a sudden they said, no, I want a part of this America. I want to get a job. Nope, we're not going to give you a job. Or we're not going to give you a high-paying job. So what happens is they're forced to live in substandard housing in one center of town that we conveniently label a ghetto. And then you say, look at those people. See that? Look, they can't do nothing. And so they're not, none have been enslaved economically. And then they have to fight themselves. And you really, and I couldn't believe it. I was talking to this fellow, you know, just in the course of meeting people, this conversation came up about affordable housing. And he said, oh, I couldn't believe it. And this time of age, he said, why the hell should we pay for housing for those people? And I just looked at him. I said, those people? I said, where the hell did you come from? You know?
Exactly.
I said, first, you inherited – he wasn't rich by any standards, but You know, you're like fourth-generation immigrant. You were handed a house. You were handed equity. What would happen if everything was taken from you today and the only thing you had was your paycheck? And tell me how bold and how successful you would be. And I said, so you don't give people a chance. You hold them up in this, and you create ghettos, and you create crime, and you create another problem. So it's just never ending. Why can't we just grow up and just be adults, you know? And
I know our time is short, so I wanted to just follow up on one other thing. With Mr. Wu, that was originally recorded in 1962, you point out in your article. But what was fascinating was that he got rediscovered and gained a new audience in 1994 through, of all people, Quentin Tarantino. Tell us about that. That is so fascinating.
Isn't it? And it was very appropriate because, you know, this music that we labeled as surf music is a little bit more universal than that. I mean, if someone never heard of surf music or Dick Dale and if they were really a musician or had an appreciation for arts and music, they would listen to this and say, well, here's somebody, this has value. Just listen to this. Listen to the text.
Right.
Look at the phrasing. Listen to what's going on here. This is a thinking musician, you know? And so it's more universal, but the downside is he gets pigeonholed into being, you know, a surf music guitarist, you know, and that's very limiting, because when you listen to his body of work, it goes well beyond that, you know, and it's sad, but I'm glad that I'm sorry about the passing. It's also a sad note that he, at 81, he had to go back on tour because he couldn't pay his medical bills for his cancer, which is a sad commentary, which is very typical of artists. Of they enrich society with, they contribute so much. You know what a lot of people forget is, you know, think of how many times we were in that not so good mood and we put on that favorite album or whatever it is. And it makes you happy, gets you through the day, and you can't put a price tag on it. And the fellow that, or that woman, or that artist you're listening to is probably starving, you know. And there's a sad, sad commentary to that.
How did you recognize that he had? How did you recognize that he had a Lebanese background? When did that come to light to you, or were you always familiar with it?
Quite honestly, I just learned about this very recently. I just started researching half ago, and I just started listening to a lot of his music and buying his music, downloading it, and looking at some of his concerts. And he was also had a good following by a younger crowd, which was very good because, you know, I think this is is intended as a compliment for the younger generations who could take a musician of maybe two generations hence and say, wow, I really respect this music, you know. And when he was, I think on one of his last tours, he actually had two very young musicians backing him up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a testament that, like, his music is timeless. It's just not surf music, you know. It's something that all people could appreciate. And, you know, so
did he get a jump start, you know, because of Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction? But that was 15 years ago.
Yeah. You know, it was recognition. I think people probably listened to it as most people said, wow, that's an interesting song. And they walked out of the movie and probably never gave it a second thought, you know. And it made, at least his music now has received a wider audience, and I think you know, there was a philosopher, I'm quoting that philosopher and I paraphrase it, I have to remember, I know he's one of the existential philosophers, I just can't remember the name, and he said, you know, there's, he says, the last death that we face is the last time our name is mentioned. And it was
yes.
very moving. And I said, you know, but at least, you know, a musician, artist, they leave something behind. You know, there's something
mm-hmm.
beyond themselves, you know. And
right.
so as long as people are clicking on and saying, hey, you know, so hopefully, you know, he'll live on for, you know, future generations and the name never goes silent. You know, I think that's
mm-hmm.
that's important. I think it's, you know, good work should never remain silent. So, you know, hopefully.
Well, it does yeah. seem that we all build on something from the past, even in the scientific world. You know, it's like everything is built on incremental evolution of knowledge, and including music
yeah.
too. You know, everything is creative, but it's built on something before it, before the present.
Yeah.
And very, very fascinating. I'm wondering if your demeanor with respect to Dale is going to be maybe the new concept of how we treat people more today. Do we actually celebrate their heritage, and do we recognize that it has influence onto their final work?
I think it's society is a little split on that. I see the
okay.
younger generation,
right.
which I have to applaud them on, are more open to it. You know, they
uh-huh.
don't see it as a hindrance to a friendship or success or anything.
Right.
I still see old, I don't know, little cells of it amongst the, you know, sometimes the, I want to say the older crowd, I'm going to say actually the baby boomer group. That,
yeah.
You know, we're the ones that went out looking for, you know, freedom rights for everyone, civil rights and things like
yeah.
that. So, you know, the bulk of us were, you know, fighting that campaign. But it's not uncommon, you know, going to a party and or just being out socially. Not that I would attend functions that these people
right.
would be there, but running into them. And you hear the comments that come off their mouth. Just very,
yeah,
it just slips off their tongue. And that's a little frightening because that means that's what's in their head. You know, if they didn't
yeah.
have to think this through, it's just a natural, I'm just a racist. I am a
so
blah,
basically,
blah, blah, blah.
So but I've noticed the same thing. So people, I'm a baby boomer myself. So, you know, I'm getting on, my God. I thought that at what I'm like 69 years old now. So I'm saying, so my God, I never even knew that you could live long enough like that, even though I knew people
yeah.
lived much longer. But the, is our generation, the baby boomers, we're still struggling with concepts that we grew up with? And are our young people now, it's not that they're dismissive of any of these biases, but it's not part of their issues that they try to surmount or eclipse.
Yeah.
It's just not there, is it?
No, it's you're right.
The bias
and,
is gone.
And a good point of what there, where it is interesting is that the, you know, when we the baby boomers get a lot of credit for, you know, their views on civil rights, the environment, and all these different
uh-huh.
things, but they were heavily influenced by the Beat Generation, and
yes,
oddly
much.
Enough, it was their that little sector of what we'd probably say. Well, beat or beatniks, which became hippies and radicals.
Right.
You come to think of it, and you say, "Look at these radicals! Look what they're looking for: equal rights, civil rights. They're radicals."
Yeah.
And you scratch your head and you say, "Isn't that in our Constitution someplace? I mean,
yeah.
you know, isn't there like some holy writ about this too? So, why is it that it's radical? I mean." Not doing it
well, you know,
is radical.
But it seems to be radical because so many in America don't even know what our forefathers and our founding fathers ever wrote.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the problem. We just are ignorant, not stupid. We're just ignorant of issues that could actually inform us in a much better way. I don't think you find this sort of a legacy like in France, for example. They all, I mean, they even know names like Rousseau and Thoreau and you know, other luminaries of their day. But they still remember, and we have forgotten.
Yeah.
Maybe that's because we're such a young country. We just don't realize that we have such history and such value in America.
You're right.
We're too
you're
young.
Right. And you're right. It's right on target. There's still a sense of this, and I'll, you know, and other writers have made reference to the closing of the American mind. And you know, for those people who just go through life, you know, oblivious to its surroundings, but. And I remember talking to a person, rather smart person, and had this conversation. And to show you how closed-minded people could be, is this person says, "I went and I read your plays. I saw your plays. They're existential. You know, they're just so moving and deep. Are you a depressant? Do you have mental illness?" And I said, "No." I said, "Actually, I have very good mental health." I said, "Well, if you don't believe me, I will. You can come and talk to, you know, the psychologist I can consult with before I release my script." And the comment was like, and I turned around and I said, "Well," I said, "as an actress, if you played the role of a prostitute, are you really a whore?" I said,
"No,
no."
Question.
I said, stop a second.
It's on target.
I'm a writer.
Brilliant.
I'm a writer. So I have to write about a character and how that character interacts with people that interacts with society. So so the writer becomes their own character in pen, and then you act it out. I said, and she said, "You know, I never thought of that." And I said, I said, I have to be very honest. I said, "This is the problem I encounter in America, is this eccentricity. This is how I see things, and I'm right." And the case. And
You're sensitive to all these things. You don't need to become a prostitute in order to be able to be sensitive to some of the issues that they have to contend with. And we don't even understand the circumstances that brought them to that particular place.
Yeah.
So, all those things come into play, but I don't know if people either – they may not have enough time in their lives to think about these things, but thank goodness there are people like you who do. And that gives us an insight into some of the issues that we need to do. I would hope that nobody would go into prostitution for whatever reasons.
Yeah. And it's just the and you know, that's the whole push of my writings and the plays and you know, hopefully short films that will be coming out, is take this little, and I want to say darkness of humanity, you know, the philosophical term is the crooked, you know, the crooked timber, you know, and how do we straighten it out? And it's because we're so blind to ourselves, you know, we just don't.
Yeah.
We're so busy throwing stones at other people. We don't bother taking a look and saying, you know, instead of finding, you know, maybe I should look at all the things that I don't do right, you know, and prove myself first and be a good example for someone to follow. And I don't even have to boast about it. I mean, you know, the actions will speak for themselves. But, you know, I think we're also a very affluent society, and, you know, we're still judged by the amount of toys we have, which are unfortunately a very poor standard of determining one's character and morality. So, but that's a battle I can't fight.
That's so true. Well, I tell you, it's one of the best things you've ever written, and it asks so many questions subliminally, and that's what makes you so brilliant, because you ask those questions. Some people will get them and others won't, but thankfully, I've gotten some of those issues subliminally. So you're very, very good.
Thank you.
Thank you so
much,
Richard.
No, I appreciate that. I look forward for these conversations and a chance for us to share it with society and share our thoughts. And it's always a pleasure.
Absolutely.
And I couldn't think of a better way to start the weekend. So,
Exactly. That's what I was thinking, the same thing. I started Monday with a bang, but it's a great way to end the week, too, with another bang. It's fantastic. Have a great weekend. Thank you so much, Dr. Richard Cerulli. Pleasure.
The best.
All
keep
the best.
And keep up the good fight. Keep up the good fight. I'm
Thank
all
you.
Behind you.
You, too. I appreciate
that.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, there we have it. None other than Dr. Richard Cerulli. His latest work is part of the Boomerang series, is an article from the from a Lebanese oud to a Fender Loud. It's in memory of Richard Anthony Mansour, who left us with a legacy that we didn't even realize, or most people didn't even realize, harkens back to the Middle East, where his parents brought him from Lebanon to Boston, Massachusetts. They gave birth to him here, and then eventually he moved out to California, was the surfer, and he was the one that epitomized, and I doubt seriously if he ever was blonde and blue-eyed, but he was the one that epitomized the surfer generation, because he created them to such a great extent because of the music. So I guess we all think of him as a blonde and blue-eyed and on the surfboard, but So very, very exciting. Give it up to Richard Cerulli for even just recognizing that. It's fantastic. Well, let's take a quick break, find out what's going on in our neck of the woods, and then we'll move on with some international news with commensurate analysis, and so we'll be back after this message.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a steno pad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Welcome back. And if you want to reach out to the Yonkers Tribune, should you be interested, they have a new phone number. It's 347-415-4326. The number 347-415-4326. You can reach them at the office using that number. You can text them. It's the cell number. You can leave a voicemail. It does it all. The only thing is it doesn't text out. So, but it received all that stuff in. So wanted to get to some international as well as national news. Evidently, President Trump has railed against the finally dead Russia probe at a recent rally. So at his first political rally since the end of the Russia collusion probe, President Donald Trump yesterday accused backers of the investigation of trying to overturn the 2016 election and attempting, quote, to illegally, end quote, to claim power. Declaring the country hurt, quote unquote, by the probe, Trump called his opponents losers, quote unquote, and celebrated the fact the investigation had come to a close. Now, after 3 years of lies and smears and slander, the Russia hoax is finally dead, he said. The collusion delusion is over, he declared. And that's what he told a crowd of thousands at a Grand Rapids arena. The Russia witch hunt was a plan by those who lost the election to try and illegally regain power by framing innocent Americans. Many of them, they suffered with an elaborate hoax, he said. On Sunday, U.S. Attorney General William Barr released a summary of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's more than 300-page report about his investigation into Russia's role in the 2016 election. Mind you, this was synopsized by the U.S. Attorney General William Barr to a four-page synopsis with a lot of redactions. So the investigation did not, that's what I've heard because I haven't seen it. The investigation did not establish that members of Trump's campaign conspired with Russia during the election. Now, the findings delighted the president and his inner circle, who spent the first 2 years of his administration confronting a cloud of suspicion over how the New York businessman and political novice won the White House. With that cloud largely lifted, Trump has let loose and calling out those who supported the investigation and referring to evil acts of treason by his opponents. Trump revisited that theme at the rally, knocking the media and Democrats and calling for accountability. Quote, these are sick people and there has to be accountability because it's all lies and they know it's lies, Trump said. For the president, the rally capped off a week of rejoicing in the results of the investigation. He had repeatedly called a witch hunt, quote unquote, and stewing over its origins. Advisors to Trump, who is not known to let go of grudges easily, have debated the merits of going after the president's opponents and those he blames for sparking the investigation versus claiming a win, moving on, and using the momentum of good news to bolster his bid for re-election. In the packed, noisy arena in Michigan, a political swing state that Trump wants to win again, 20, the view of the crowd was clear. Thousands of supporters, many of them wearing red Make America Great Again hats, cheered as the president railed at his opponents. But they seemed as eager to cheer him over policy issues, applauding loudly when he assured them he was building a wall along the U.S. border with Mexico and promised to secure the border. The industrial state, along with Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, helped propel Trump, a Republican, to his improbable victory in 2016. Even by his own presumption, he didn't think he would win. So the crowd's enthusiasm underscored the risks to Trump of going too far, expounding on his chagrin over the Mueller probe. Some advisors feel his best bet is to focus on the strong economy and success in enacting administration priorities like the tax overhaul. Now, Mueller left unresolved in his report the question of whether Trump committed obstruction of justice by impeding the Russia investigation. In his letter to Congress, Barr said he and his deputy, Rod Rosenstein, determined there was insufficient evidence to establish that the president committed obstruction of justice, and Democrats were not satisfied with Barr's determination and have demanded to see the report in full. Some Republicans, including Trump himself, have also voiced support for releasing it. Trump faces other investigations into his personal and business affairs from Democratic lawmakers who now control the U.S. House of Representatives. But Democrats also risk alienating voters weary of the Russian probe. Trump told his rally, his opponents now had to decide whether to keep up their partisan investigations or apologize to Americans and focus on issues like infrastructure and health care. Very, very compelling, to say the least. So we're going to find out where that goes. Still in the Northern Hemisphere. And this time it's all about the Venezuelan government barring Guaido from public office for the next 15 years. Well, the Venezuelan government said opposition leader Juan Guaido would be barred from public office for 15 years as of Thursday, as it seeks to crack down on the U.S.-backed rival to President Nicolas Maduro. Now, the move announced by Auditor General Elvis Amoroso on state television marked another effort by Maduro's regime to politically sideline Guaido, who is recognized by the United States and 50 other countries as Venezuela's interim president. Now, Amoroso said his office decided to, quote, ban this citizen, Juan Guaido, from all elected public office for the maximum duration under the law. Well, Venezuela's single-chamber Congress called the National Assembly is in opposition hands and stands as the sole institution not under the control of Maduro. Well, the country's Supreme Court and a parallel legislature set up by Maduro in 2017 regularly adopt decisions scrapping National Assembly motions against the regime. National Assembly, for its part, often ignores or passes laws annulling decisions by what it regards as an illegitimate regime, asserting that Guaido is in charge of the country constitutionally. Although Maduro's government has heeded warnings from the United States to not arrest Guaido or face unspecified repercussions, the opposition leader's chief of staff was taken into custody last week and charged with terrorism. Well, Maduro has also accused Guaido and the opposition of terrorist acts, quote unquote, that caused a massive nationwide blackout for 3 days this week that authorities appear to have repaired by Thursday. Now, the socialist president has been bolstered by the arrival last weekend of 100 Russian troops and Moscow's vow to stand up against what it said was a coup, quote unquote, being fomented by Washington. However, internationally, Maduro has been weakened by Guaido's rise to lead the previously fractured opposition and his endorsement as interim leader by most Western countries and big Latin American nations. United States has handed diplomatic missions and seats on some international organizations to Guaido's representatives, booting out Maduro's envoys. In a month, Washington is set to greatly ratchet up its sanctions on Venezuela by banning crude imports from the country, yanking a top revenue earner for Caracas's already badly depleted coffers. And U.S. President Donald Trump on Wednesday told Russia to get out of Venezuela. Moscow responded by saying its troops will stay, quote, for as long as necessary, end quote. Very, very compelling, to say the least. Now let's see what Russia did say about these issues. So Russia has rejected Trump's call to pull the military personnel out of Venezuela. Whoa. Russia said on Thursday that specialists, quote unquote, it sent to Venezuela under a military cooperation deal posed no threat to regional stability, brushing aside a call from U.S. President Donald Trump to remove all military personnel from the country. Trump said on Wednesday that, quote, all options, end quote, were open to make Russia pull troops out of Venezuela after two Russian Air Force planes landed outside Caracas on Saturday last week, carrying nearly 100 Russian military personnel, according to media reports. So as Venezuela has descended into political turmoil this year, Russia has emerged as a staunch backer of President Nicolas Maduro, while the United States backs the country's opposition and has imposed sanctions. Venezuela's military attaché in Moscow said on Thursday Russia had sent servicemen, quote unquote, to Venezuela, but that they would not take part in military operations, Interfax news agency reported. The presence of Russian servicemen in Venezuela is linked to the discussion of cooperation in the military technical sphere, said Jose Rafael Torrealba Perez, who was quoted as saying that. So, speaking at a weekly news briefing on Thursday, Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova described the arrivals only as, quote, Russian specialists, end quote. Quote, she says, Russia is not changing the balance of power in the region. Russia is not threatening anyone. Unlike officials in Washington, she told a weekly news briefing. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said that Russia's specialists were in Venezuela to service pre-existing contracts for the supply of Russian arms. He told reporters on a conference call that Russia was not interfering in Venezuela's internal affairs and that the Kremlin hoped other countries would also allow Venezuelans to decide their own fate. Quote, we don't think that third countries should worry about our bilateral ties, Peskov added. Dismissing the Russian assurances, Patrick Shanahan, the acting U.S. Defense Secretary, later commented, quote, I'm not sure I always believe what they say, end quote. Russia and China have backed Maduro, while the United States and most other Western countries support opposition leader Juan Guaido. In January, Guaido invoked the Constitution to assume Venezuela's interim presidency, arguing that Maduro's 2018 re-election was illegitimate, and Maduro, who retains control of state functions and the country's military, has said that Guaido is a puppet of the United States. Whoa. You know, go figure on that one. Well, so very, very compelling stuff, to say the least. And troublesome as well. So we'll see where all that goes. Now let's move on to see what's going on in Europe. And it seems that the British ministers of parliament are voting on May's Brexit deal. So it's going to be interesting to see where that goes. And we'll see what happens. This is really compelling because it asks many questions. Evidently, a record 1,100 dead dolphins washed up on French beaches. Well, the dolphins' bodies were horribly mutilated, the fins cut off, but shocked French marine researchers wasn't just the brutality of the deaths of these highly intelligent mammals, but the numbers involved. A record 1,100 have landed on France's Atlantic coast beaches since January. The mass deaths, widely blamed on industrial fishing, have alarmed animal welfare groups and prompted France's ecology ministry to launch a national plan to protect them. There's never been a number this high, said Willie Daubin, a member of La Rochelle University's National Center for Scientific Research. Quote, already in 3 months, we have beaten last year's record, which was up from 2017, and even that was the highest in 40 years. Though Daubin and 90% of the fatalities resulted from the dolphins being accidentally captured in industrial fishing nets, the reason behind this spike this year is a mystery. What fishing machinery or equipment is behind all these deaths, he asked. Autopsies carried out on the dolphins this year at La Rochelle University show extreme levels of mutilation. Activists say it's common for fishermen to cut body parts off the suffocated dolphins after they are pulled up on the nets to save the nets. Now, French ecology minister François de Rougy rushed last week to La Rochelle in an attempt to lower the number of dolphins dying as a result of humans. He's under pressure, partly due to French President Emmanuel Macron's pro-ecology stance and oft-quoted slogan to, quote, make the planet great again, end quote. Rougy has come up with some plans, including bolstering research from existing acoustic repellent devices in place in 26 two-vessel trawlers, an industrial fishing hub in the Atlantic Ocean. And when activated, the devices send unpleasant signals to nearby dolphins that cause them to swim away. But animal rights group Sea Shepherd said this his measure do not go far enough and has already decided the acoustic repellents as useless, quote unquote. It claims many of the trawlers they watch in the region don't activate the repellent devices, fearing they will scare off valuable fish as well, and only turn them on if they are being checked by fishing monitors. It also said that increasing the number of repellent devices is not a long-term solution, since that makes the oceans an uninhabitable drum of noise pollution for all mammals and fish. The government needs to take responsibility and act, especially Macron, who said he wanted to protect ecology. Lamia SM Lali, president of Sea Shepherd France, told the Associated Press. She cited scientists who predict that the current rates of fishing will likely drive the dolphin population to extinction. The spotlight has been put on the trawlers that fish for sea bass, which is a scandal, but they were not the only ones responsible, she said. She suggested that aggressive hake fishing, which was given the green light 3 years ago after a long ban, was a major factor. The spike in dolphin deaths also began 3 years ago. Her group says the ecological crisis stems from unprecedented demand for low-cost fish. Right now, the sea bass that is being caught by the trawlers that kill dolphins you can find on the French market for at $4 a pound, she said. And global seafood consumption has more than doubled in the last 50 years, according to European Commission, a rate that rights groups have branded unsustainable. So unbelievable that this is happening, but it just is what it is. Now, let's see what else is happening here. I think we covered that. The big story is what's going to happen with regard to Brexit and what will Britain do. But we don't have any new news with respect to that, so we'll just have to see where that goes. Evidently, and this is really quite interesting, the Philippines have arrested a journalist and who is a Duterte, President Duterte critic. So that's not such a great thing. But it just is what it is. Let's go back to what's going on in New Zealand. Thousands have gathered for the New Zealand Attack Remembrance Service. A Maori lament echoed across Christchurch on Friday as a survivor of the New Zealand mosque attacks told a national remembrance service he had forgiven the gunman responsible for the racist massacre that shocked the world. Thousands attended the service in the grieving southern city, the southern island city, of standing silently with heads bowed while the names of 50 people killed by a self-avowed white supremacist gunman were read out. The speakers honored the dead and those who survived the March 15 attacks, including 22 people who remain in hospital, among them a critically injured four-year-old girl. Wearing a traditional Maori cloak, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern was joined by representatives from nearly 60 nations, including her Australian counterpart, Scott Morrison. Ardern, who has been widely held for her response to the tragedy and received a prolonged standing ovation when she took the stage, praised the way New Zealanders had embraced their devastated Muslim community since the attacks. "Racism exists, but it is not welcome here," she said. "An assault on the freedom of any one of us who practice their faith or religion is not welcome here. Violence and extremism in all its forms is not welcome here," she said. The hastily organized service was held amid tight security, with Police Commissioner Mike Bush confirming armed police from Australia were on site to assist their New Zealand counterparts. The service heard a Muslim invocation or Dua Stevens, the British singer who shunned stardom in the 1970s and became a Muslim, taking the name Yusuf Islam, gave a powerful rendition of his hit song, Peace Train. But the most moving speech came from Farid Ahmed, whose wife Husna was killed as she rushed back into a mosque trying to rescue her disabled husband. Sitting in his wheelchair before the assembled crowd, Ahmed said he forgave the accused gunman, Australian Brenton Tarrant. "People ask me, why do you forgive someone who has killed your beloved wife?" he said. "I can give so many answers. Allah says if we forgive one another, he loves us." Echoing Ardern's theme that extremism should not be allowed to breed extremism, Ahmed received a standing ovation when he said he chose peace over anger. "I don't want a heavy heart boiling like a volcano with anger, fury, and rage. It burns inside and burns its surroundings," he said. "I want a heart full of love, care, and mercy. This heart does not want any more lives to be lost, any other human to go through the pain I've gone through. That's why I am choosing peace and I have forgiven." Christchurch Mayor Leon Dalziel said the atrocity was an attack on us all. she said. And those actions were designed to divide us and tear us apart, she said. They have instead united us. Among the crowd, Azra Chida traveled from Auckland to attend the service, saying she lost two close friends in the attack. Quote, I've come to see their families and pay respect and visit the patients in the hospital, she told Agence France Presse shortly before the ceremony began. Local man Bobby Turner said, I'm here for solidarity, to show that we care. It was just such a horrible thing to happen. And these people were just going about their business. Prayer is supposed to be about love and peace. It's very, very compelling stuff. And, you know, wow, it's just going to be just really fascinating how all this plays out over time. Now, let me just quickly look at something else. Bear with me a moment. I think we're going to move on to another part of the world. Bear with me a second. I want to go over to the Middle East. One second. Now, I think we covered most of the stuff. I was looking for something new to have taken place, but we talked about this yesterday, about the hospital that was hit in an air attack as Yemenis marked 4 years of war. So, you know, that's what's been going on, and it's going to be very, very interesting to see how all that comes about. So I think that's where we are today. I see it's about 11 o'clock. We're going to close the day. Well, let me just quickly check to see if something happened in Africa. Bear with me a moment. Oh, yes, I forgot to mention this as well. Evidently, Algeria's protesters are expanding their focus to the political elite beyond Bouteflika, so they hope that they, too, will just disperse because they're not interested in the same old crowd, as they say. This is really quite interesting as well. Evidently, a former French spy has been linked to a Congo murder plot, was shot dead in the Alps. It seemed a former French secret agent who was being investigated for a plot to kill an exiled Congolese opposition leader has been shot dead in the French Alps. Daniel Forestier, 57, who lived in the Alps region in eastern France, was found dead last Thursday in a remote car park in the small town of Bayazon, near Lake Geneva. He had been shot five times, including in the head and heart. His lawyer, Cedric Huissoud, told reporters. Forestier and another former agent from France's External Intelligence Service, the DGSE, were placed under formal investigation last September for criminal conspiracy, quote-unquote, and, quote, possession of explosives, end quote, in connection with a plot to murder Congolese General Ferdinand Mbau, who has lived in exile in France for some 20 years. Now, Forestier is believed to have worked for 14 years for the GSE. He was living in the small town of Lucinge near the Swiss border, where he had served as the town council and ran a cafe. Now, according to French media, investigators have not yet established a link between his death and the plot to murder Mbau, but the manner of his killing suggested it was the work of professionals. Citing France's domestic intelligence agency, the DGSI, French daily Le Monde, said Forestier had admitted he was part of a hit squad tasked with eliminating the Congolese dissident. According to the report, Forestier told DGSI's agents that reconnaissance missions in May and June of 2018 had led him to believe the plot was not feasible, quote-unquote. In October, Mbau told Agence France-Presse he was angry at the aborted plot but was not surprised, end quote. Like a number of France-based opponents of Republic of Congo's president, Denis Sassou Nguesso, Mbau believed he was targeted for criticizing one of Africa's longest-serving leaders from what he thought to be a safe distance. The 62-year-old general is known for his outspoken attacks on Sassou Nguesso, who has ruled the former French colony in oil-rich Central African country, also known as Congo-Brazzaville, for some 35 years. Congo-Brazzaville is borders what was also another Congo, but that was in Kinshasa, which was at one time called Zaire. So that's Congo-Kinshasa. Mbau told Congo after his former boss, fled Congo after his former boss, the country's first democratically elected president, Pascal Lissouba, was overthrown by Sassou Nguesso in 1997. He had already survived an attempt to his life. Mbau believes it was the regime that sent hitmen to shoot him in the back as he was leaving his home in Bessancourt, north of Paris, in November of 2015. He still has the bullet lodged in his torso. The doctors couldn't remove it because it is in a tricky spot close to the heart, he told Agence France-Presse. No one has ever charged, or no one was ever charged over the attack. So, my goodness, you know, the constant intrigues of the world, huh? And, 1 second. And just so you know, I'm not going to cover this. Evidently, Cameroon's Anglophone separatist conflict has hit the economy very badly. So it's going to be very interesting to see where all that goes. So we'll just have to see what can be done. So that seems to be the story. Let me quickly get back to our screen. And just want to thank you for being with us. And next week, we're going to be speaking, of course, to Michael Edelman, the political analyst, on Monday. And then we're also going to speak to John Bailey on Monday. And then we'll do some more international news as well. So we'll see what happens and what transpires over the weekend. So all the best to everyone. Thank you so much. Be well and stay healthy, and enjoy the weekend. Goodbye.